ॐ सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।
We're on verse 34.
Ahasputam tattvamasi vedaha. Ahasputam tattvamasi vedaha. Tatapya samprapya paratmanishtam.
Tatapya
samprapya paratmanishtam. Bhuyo vicharo mati durbhalatvam. Bhuyo vicharo mati durbhalatvam. Tatsarvada swatmataya hi bhati. Tatsarvada swatmataya hi bhati. So, it says here, the Vedas, Vedaha, Aha. The Vedas say, means the Vedas are the Hindu scriptures, the Upanishads. So the Upanishads say, the Vedas say. The Vedas say, sputam, very clearly. Sputam means crystal, like a crystal. Clear like a crystal. So the Vedas say clearly, Tat tvam asi iti. The Vedas clearly say you are that. Not that you will become that, you know, not that you have to do anything to become that, simply you are that. The tvam means you. When they say the Mahavakya, it's really the whole Upanishad is centered on the unfoldment of the Mahavakya. The Mahavakya doesn't translate well, but it means that essential statement which is the vision that's being imparted by the Upanishad. So literally it means the great statement. Maha is great and Vakya statement. So it's a great statement. So we just say Mahavakya. Okay. So the Mahavakya, there's many. They all say the same thing, though, in different words. One is Tat Tvam Asi. It's a very famous one. You are that. Means, when we say that, means you, this individual person, this conscious being who's sitting here, the conscious being that you are is that. And so you can take the tat to mean is that Brahman, means the self that you are, yourself is infinite. Your being is infinite. That's one way to take tatvamasi. The other is to say like this, you, this jiva, this person, individual, transmigrating jiva, person sitting here, you are Ishwara, you are the Lord. And from the Vedantic standpoint, how the Upanishads will unfold, the Lord, Ishwara, is the one who manifests as this entire infinite creation. Everything that the manifestation of the creation is looked at as almost like an infinite mind, in the sense that the entire creation and everything that exists in it, everything that exists within duality, is known and enjoys oneself. And so the entire creation is one infinite conscious being that we call Ishwara. And so the Mahavakya says, you, oh little individual, you are Ishwara. And immediately the mind will say, how could I possibly be Ishwara, because I am limited. I am limited by time and space and quality. So this individual here can't possibly be the infinite Lord, the one whose form is manifest as this entire creation, both subtle and gross. And so the Upanishads are mad, you know, or there's something to be understood. And what is to be understood in this Mahavakya, where every Upanishad is going through many different, what we call prakriyas, teaching methodologies to unfold this to you, is that the conscious being that you are, this presence, as we did in the meditation, your own presence, the one who is present, the awareful being, because of whom all of the experiences that you have, all of the thoughts that you have, the perceptions, the emotions, the moods, the images, the dreams, whatever, the memories, whatever thought modifications or feelings come into the mind, which are also perceptual, all of those are coming and going in your presence. And that presence is different than that, in that your presence is not coming and going. Your presence, your being, simply is. And it simply is known, is what Ramana will say. It is known because it is self-evident. because it is consciousness. You don't need to bring in another consciousness, you know, to illumine the conscious being that you are. And that would be like an infinite regress, consciousness of consciousness of consciousness. There's no end to it. But consciousness is what we say, swatthasiddha. Swatthasiddha means it's self-evident. Self-evident means you don't need another pramana or another means of knowledge to come in to allow it to be known. But actually it's the bottom line. Because of you, because of your self-evident, the me, the conscious being that you are, that self-evident being, because of it, all of your thoughts are known. Right? And the thoughts come and go in that self-evident being. So thoughts come into being, they're known, they go out, they're unknown. Right? So they have to be present to be known. You know, otherwise they can be stored in the chitta, in the memory, but when they're stored in the memory at that time, they're not known to you. They're out of your realm of experience. When they come into the mind, say you recall something that you did, that's memory, then now that becomes known. This isn't true for you. Your being simply is self-evident. And so now here, what Ramana is pointing out, something very simple. He's saying, the Vedas tell, they tell very clearly, Sputum, that you, that self-evident being that you are, you know, that self-evident being that you are in fact Brahman. Your Brahman means your being is something that is not bound by change. It's not coming and going. Your being is not something that can be objectified as an object. Once it's objectified as an object, then it's limited by all the other objects. This chair is different than this rug. It's different than this cloth. We just look at this room. We can differentiate everything so clearly. But all of these things that we're differentiating are objects. You know, they're objects within time and space. And so we can infinitely differentiate them, in fact. And they're also bound by time. Anything that exists within time and space, you know, is bound by time. They're bound by time, bound by change. Bound by change, change, another way to talk about change is birth and death. So that is the nature of all of our experience, right? But all of our experience in terms of things that can be objectified, consciousness can't be objectified. You become an object within time and space. Because if you objectify consciousness, then who's the one objectifying it? You can't have consciousness aware of another consciousness. However, you are aware of yourself without any duality. There's no subject-object relationship. You're aware of yourself as though it's kind of a confusing way to say it. But what we do is we say you are self-shining. The me that you are, is self-evident, self-luminous. Your being is self-evident, self-luminous. And when you just sit quietly in contemplation as we did today, you can differentiate you. You are different from all of the experiences that come and go. All experiences come and go, except for you. You are there as the very changeless, non-objectifiable experience presence in all of these experiences. So now what he says is, all the Vedas clearly say this. Then he says, but still, tathapi. He says, but still, asamprapya, having not realized this, realized what? The paramatma nishtan. Having not attained that paramatma nishtha. What that means is this. Yourself, the self that you are, is self-shining and self-evident. Okay? Like for all of us in this room, with or without knowledge, who've never heard Vedanta or never experienced this type of teaching before, doesn't make any difference. Each one of us equally will say, I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. Yourself, whether you have knowledge or not, is totally irrelevant to your own presence. You don't need knowledge to be. Your presence illumines your knowledge, your lack of knowledge. Right? Your presence, your being, illumines your knowledge and your ignorance. Like I can say, I can check out in my mind, do I know Chinese? No, I don't. I'm totally ignorant. But have I ever studied the Vedas? Say I haven't. No, I don't even know what they are. I read the Upanishads, say I never have. No, what are they? It's very common. What are they? But I illumined that. I have no idea. Do you have self-knowledge? Oh, no, definitely I don't. Not in the Eastern, way that they use the word. I have self-knowledge more in a psychological sense. I could say that that's actually a very educated thing to say. Because I'm making a differentiation. That's kind of a nice thing. So what I'm saying is that your being is just simply, very simply, your presence is just always there shining, illuminating whatever, knowledge, ignorance, whatever the type of thought modifications are coming, whatever the emotions are coming, you simply are. And so he says, having not recognized that fact, as some, the unnegates, the sumprapya means to have clearly gained that recognition, clearly recognized the nishta, the paramatma nishta. Atma means the self, that atma nishta, the nishta in the myself as paramatma, the paramatma. Or he says paratma, paratma, paramatma, same. Paratma means the self which is parama, the self that can no, that cannot be objectified. Right? The self that cannot be objectified, meaning that can't become an object within the creation, is what we say has got to be, for Sanskrit people, deshakalavastu aparicheda. That's what we mean by para or param. It's something which can't be limited by space, because you illumine space. Atma is not something that is an object within space. It illumines space itself. It can't be limited by space. Kala, it can't be limited by time, because time requires duality. Time requires change. And so if you're not an object within time and space, you yourself don't have change available to you. In fact, you're the timeless presence that illumines past, present, and future. Right? In fact, if we were to go into that just for a minute, in reference to time, yourself is the one who's present to time, and in fact, yourself that illumines time really only illumines the present. In fact, you never experience anything but the present. And we don't think about it like that because we have memory and we have projections. We're either thinking or remembering what we did yesterday or what we did in the last hour, or we're thinking about what we're going to do in the future. But all of those memories and projections into the future are always taking place right now. Right? So even a memory, you bring a memory, that's taking place in the present. You think of some future projection, what you're going to do, that's taking place in the present. You are never, ever outside of the present. Right? And yourself is the presence of the present. You see what I mean? Because you're the presence, your being is the presence of the present, because the present is also, if we were to just look into it for a minute, the present is not something you can actually find in your experience. You can only find the present in reference to your own being. Because the presence in reference to your experience is infinitely divisible. Because time is infinitely divisible. So say you take this moment. How long does this moment last? You know, that moment can be cut in half. That moment can be cut in half. That moment can be cut in half. Swamiji uses the example of, in India, you know, they do pujas with flower petals. Like they'll take the petals apart and make a big pile of flower petals. So he said, what if you took, and these flower petals are so beautiful and delicate, what if you took like 500 flower petals, put them together like that, and then you took a sharp needle and you went through like that. That's a moment. But that moment is 500 moments. Right? Because one petal at a time. Like that. Time is infinitely divisible, so you're, even the idea that you can cognize a present is illusory because time moves so quickly. In fact, this one scientist, Kai Chu, was one of Swamiji's students, did a study using some very high-tech equipment to try to see if he could capture a moment, you know, that was not a squiggly line. And he couldn't. He got down to some huge, most minute amount of time.
1 millionth.
1 millionth or something. Just extraordinary. And he was able to get a shot of that in itself was a squiggly line that could be divided, you know. And so we don't worry about this, though, because for us, we are the present, you know, in which time takes place. So the time has to do with this creation that we experience. The time is related to change. Without change, there's no time. Doesn't bother us because we are the steady. We're the steady state, the changeless state. So we're the presence that allows for the experience of a presence, of a present. You see what I mean? And so here, this Paramatma, so Desha Kala, yes, the third one is Vastu. We can't be an object. We can't be differentiated one object from another unless we can objectify, be something that's subject to the objective subject-object relationship. Consciousness can't be objectified. Who's going to objectify it? Who would objectify consciousness? Consciousness. But that's an infinite regress. And so consciousness itself becomes the bottom line. You, your being, is the bottom line. So say that fact of your own presence has not been discerned. Like he says, so he's, what he's saying now, even though the Vedas say this so clearly, you are that Paramatma, you are that being which is free of time, free of space, free of objectivity, you are limitless. Parama means limitless. What limitless means is this desha, kala, vastu, aparichay. Space, time, objectivity. You are free of that. Your being is free of that. So you are limitless. Okay. So, having not recognized, then he says, bhuyaha, again vicharaha. Again you do vichara. Vichara means again you do analysis. Let me explain this a little bit. The Upanishads themselves will start out in one way or another. They have different methods of doing this, but they'll start in one way or another talking about who is the first of all, who is the qualified student for this knowledge. And it'll say, it'll divide the qualified students, all of whom are qualified students. So say there's a group of qualified students. It means people who can benefit from this knowledge. You know? I'll explain that in a little bit of depth. So qualified student. He says there are three types. There's the Uttama Adhikari, the Madhyama Adhikari, and Mandana Adhikari. The Adhikari means qualified student. The Uttama Adhikari is the most qualified. Uttama means they are on the top, the absolute top of being qualified. The Madhyama are somewhere in the middle. And the Mandana need more work to do. But they are still Adhikaris. That's an important thing to understand there. It's not that the Mandana, in fact, we're all Mandanas really, well, just to be honest about it, we're not in that Uttama. But Ramanayas. Ramanayas. By the time the pundits and the who taught Ramana the Upanishads got to him, his mind is just abided naturally in samadhi. He just was with himself. So he would say, for someone like him, or an Uttama Adhikari, Paratma Nishtha, that firm abiding, Nishtha means that clarity, that firm abiding in your own being, you know, which is itself changeless and limitless and totally unencumbered, you know. If, in spite of what the Upanishads say, in spite of them unfolding this, so say we've all sat through the Upanishad, which is taught, properly taught, there's a tradition of teaching for the Upanishad. It's really the Guru Sisha dialogue. It's not just reading a book. There's an actual methodology for teaching it. So say we've all sat through it, first part, so part one, section one of the Upanishad, you know. And at this point, the Uttama Adhikari would say, yes, and leave. It's fine. All is well. Now, the Madhyama Adhikari would say, could you tell me that again? Could you, I don't quite understand. So what he says here is, bhuyaha vichara. Vichara is that Let me hear this again in another way, or please make this clear. Vichara, give me more analysis. Help me to understand. That's what we mean by vichara. Vichara literally means analysis. Sometimes we use the word viveka. Viveka means a discriminative analysis. Because here you are. You know, yourself is here, and you are kind of the center to an incredible amount of input. You know, and so a viveka, a discriminative analysis is necessary to be able to differentiate yourself amidst all of this input, all of this change, and then to recognize the relationship between your being and all of this change. That requires some vichara. Okay, so what Ramana says here, to ask again for that vichara, bhuyaha vicharaha, shows mati durbalatvam. Durbalatvam means like weakness. Your mind is a little weak, you know. Now, what is the mind? What does that mean? Your mind is a little bit weak. Well, it means that when a person is qualified for this knowledge, they have enough of the qualifications to make them really a mumukshu, but they still have a ways to go. Now, say, I'm just going to list these for you, and you can say, you know, just analyze yourself, and you'll say, You say, you know, I do have that to some degree. Definitely. You'll say that about all of them. Yes, I do have that to some degree. Like, say, let's look at the first one. Viveka. What viveka means, the definition of it is nitya, anitya vastu viveka. It means the ability to discriminate between what is timeless and what is time-bound. Now, when a student comes to the teacher, to this teaching, they won't know what is timeless. They don't know that. They know what is time-bound. And so, if a student clearly recognizes that everything in this world is time-bound, is subject to change and subject to death, every experience that I have, you know, of these experiences come and go. That means that everything I want, or everything that I need, or everything that I love, or everything that I work for, I can get it, but it's time-bound. And if you've really thought more, even more about it, you'll think, and even the things that I want, my want itself is time-bound. Yeah. So there, in fact, on both ends, the world that I experience, including my physical body, all time-bound. The mind that I experience also, all time-bound. Like, what if you say, I want this, and you really want it, and then you get it, and a few months later, or it could be the next day, or the next hour, you don't want it anymore. And now this thing that you wanted so badly becomes a burden. This is how it is, and this is everybody's experience. I happen to remember very clearly when I was about 18 or so, or somewhere in there, kind of having a horrified feeling when I watched my desire for something or someone go. You want something or you want somebody and then you don't want them. How could that be? It's like saying you love somebody and then you don't love them. And they're still there waiting to be loved. You love them, you don't love them. And then you say, what has happened? How is that even possible? It's very sobering. And as a person starts realizing the kind of the temporal nature of all experience, both on the side of the subject and on the side of the object. By subject, I mean your mind and sense organs and this person. Your desires and your experiences are temporal, and your body and the world that you're experiencing is temporal also, because the same thing can happen on both sides. And so now say, you become aware of that. Now, you might think, because all of you are going to be aware of this to some degree, but for many people, I'd say like 95 or 98% of the world, it's not that they're not aware of it, but it's not an important thought. Like if I were to say that to somebody, they would say, of course. Because it's a no-brainer. Of course it is. But so what? But a mumukshu has that viveka to a given degree, to a degree to where it matters, because that recognition has consequences. And the consequences are that then there is nothing in this world that can give me any type of lasting fullness. I can't complete myself in this world because this world is just made up of temporal experiences. So I can have a series of temporal experiences, some good, some bad, but I can't just lay back and relax and say, now all is well. That's not possible, you know, unless I'm able to say I enjoy being unhappy. And you cannot say I enjoy being unhappy unless the person who's saying that is happy. It's a kind of a, you know, thing. Really? So this viveka, this discrimination, leads to a vairagya, a dispassion, which some in Christian lore, they call it like the dark night of the soul. Because all of a sudden you realize that I can't really fulfill myself in a meaningful way, whereas up until that time I've collected this, and if I could just do that and add this to it, and I fit in a cocktail. And I keep shifting, adjusting the cocktail, thinking, oh, this will be finally the elixir, and I'll have everything now. I can say all is well with me. And that does not happen. It never happens, and it never will happen. At some point you realize, oh my God, it will never happen, because it can't, because the universe can't give that to me. Let me put it this way. It will never happen if you have projected the source of that ananda or fullness or happiness onto something which is time-bound. If you have done that, then it simply can't happen because you've projected on something that's time-bound. So that viveka and vairagya, as I'm talking about that, you will have recognized that to a certain degree, and you will have had that vairagya or dispassion to a certain degree. You know? So say, here's maturity and here's zero. You're going to be somewhere in here with a ways to go. You know, because I still want this and I still want that, even though I know all this, but still. So there's assimilation that has to be done. Then there's another set of qualities called their mental qualities. One of them is shama, very important quality. Shama means, and I would say all of us have shama probably a huge percentage of the time. Shama means that when a thought arises, or a feeling or emotion arises, you have a choice to dismiss it. You know how many thoughts you let just pass through? How many thoughts you blow off? How many feelings? Oh, that doesn't matter. Nothing. It's no problem for you at all. Most of your thoughts are no problem. And there is a river of thoughts flowing through and feelings through, some currents going through all the while. They're fine. They're so fine that you don't even think about it. And that's why you don't even notice it. Because it's just the flow of the mind. But there is a percentage of thoughts or feelings that you cannot do that with. They're like these boulders. And there's no budging it. It's like this thought will come and it grabs me. Right? And then I will have like a web of thoughts building up, circling around until I get this kind of big mess inside. You know, all circling around this. It's like a spider's web kind of, where it's this poor little, you know, little fly is caught in the spider's web and the whole thing is just going around and around and around and it can't move. And so we develop situations like that. That's lack of shama. But shama means that it's easy for you to blow off the thoughts. Like, it's fine. If the thought isn't not useful, or it's, you know, it's something that is, it's not necessary to go there, you have a choice. So you'll have shama to some degree. Actually, a great deal of shama, but it's those little ones that cause problems. So, you know, For those problems, there's what we call dhamma. This is another important one. Can you have an emotional reaction where you've been caught, it's in your body, it's an emotional reaction, do you have the wherewithal to not act it out? Like, can you, you know, when if you get really angry about something, can you hold it? You know? Can you verbally hold it? Can you physically hold it? You know? At least you can contain it. And if you look at yourself, you can say, for the most part, I can do that. None of us are going to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that at all. We'd be in the loony bin. So actually, we do have that capacity to probably a pretty high degree. I'm not perfect. So shama, dhamma, upadati. Are these recognitions, the viveka, the vairagya, you know, are they such, let me say it in even a more general way. Does your mind, for you just as a personality, are you able to stay with something for a long period of time? Can you hold your interest? Like say, for instance, you want to be a musician. In India, and I think that's kind of more generally accepted now, also, you know, it takes 12 years to develop really a mastery in anything. And that's just the beginning of mastery. 12 years. And that's 12 years of focused attention on something, even in art or music or writing or any skill, but also in something like this knowledge. You know? First of all, do you have the capacity for that type of commitment? And second of all, is the last quality, which we call mumukshutvam, that desire for liberation, has that desire for liberation come forth in you because of the viveka and vairagya, that dispassion and discrimination and dispassion? Has that been enough to give you that desire for liberation where you kind of throw up your hands and say, okay, God, if you're there, please save me. If there's any truth, if there's anything, any way out of this, please help me. Because I can't solve this problem. That's a huge recognition. I can't solve the problem because the solution doesn't exist within time and space. And if I'm projecting wholeness, well-being onto the creation, I cannot solve the problem. And where else am I going to project it? So that if that mumukshutvam is there, then you have a chance for that upadati, which means the ability to stay with something for a while. Then another one is samadhanam. Say you have I'll do pratiksha first, is the ability to be able to withstand the vagaries of the world, because say you have all of this and you want to study, but you just can't stand the things that the world throws at you, which are significant, and they're opposites. Sometimes it gives you something really nice, a nice situation, and you just feel wonderful and cared for, and oh yes, there really is a God, you know, because this nice thing has been given to me, and I can relax and really enjoy, or it's a beautiful day, and I have the free time to take a walk, or whatever, you know, I can enjoy that. But then, what about when I was waiting for, you know, a clear day, I've been waiting and waiting, and it was promised to me, and what happens when I get up is that it's pouring rain, and it spoils my whole day. These are silly things, but we have expectations. We want the situation to be in a certain way, and if it's in that way, I'm happy, and if it is not in that way, I'm not happy. Titiksha means I'm able to endure the reality of the creation, which is not just one way, it's opposites. You know, there are situations that are as though designed for your happiness and situations that are designed for your pain. In fact, they say that within the Indian tradition, that when you take this human birth, it's comprised of 50-50, punya and papa. You know, I mean, that's held within the Indian culture, so I'm sharing that with you. That this birth, it was one birth of many. Your karmas have now manifest to take you in this birth from your birth to your death. And on this particular plane of existence, the karmas that that are being exhausted at this time are 50% punya, 50% papa. Means 50% designed for situations that will be pleasing to you, and 50% designed for situations that will be more difficult for you. You don't have to be hurt or made be happy by them. But if you don't have any other abiding space inside of yourself, then this situation will tend to make you miserable, and this one will tend to make you happy. So like that, in gradiated degrees, unhappy, irritated, miserable, furious, etc. Happy, pleasant, beautifully exalted states, etc. Like that. So that's the world. So that's titiksha. Can you handle that world? Can you handle the differences in between hot and cold? You know, different types of food, etc. So titiksha, if you have that titiksha, then you have the wherewithal to be able to focus on something that's important to you. Another one is samadhanam. Samadhanam is, say you're listening to this class. This is different than upadati. Say you're trying to listen to this class and your mind can't stop wandering. So you'll catch a few words and your mind will go out and you'll come back and catch a few more words. And then it can go out for a really long time and come back. I mean, have you ever, you know, like if you're reading a novel or something, we've all had, or even if you're driving your car, how did I get there? I don't remember, you know? So is the mind, is your mind available to you? It's another quality. Another one, the last one of this group is Shraddha. Does your mind have a disposition toward, remember this is an adhikari for this particular knowledge, okay? Does it have a disposition called like a faith, pending understanding, that even allows you to listen? It's a big thing to spend your time listening, you know? You have to get in the car and you have to come to the class and then you have to sit for an hour. Some shraddha is involved. You have to think that this teaching has something to offer and this teacher who's teaching it is okay. Both teacher and the knowledge. Otherwise, there's nothing in your heart that's going to hold you there. And they say, what would give you the shraddha? What would even give it to you? And they say, well, it's the grace of God. It's Ishwara Anugraha. It's the grace of God, because how can you have shraddha in somebody you don't know and a teaching you don't know? How do you know? You know? How do you know if that person knows anything? How do you know if the Upanishads can really deliver the goods or whatever the spiritual path is? How do you know? So there's just something inside that says, yes, I want to see. It's not a faith, an endless faith. It's I want to see and I'm willing to see. You know, that's a very important quality. So now all of these things have to be there in a certain at a certain level of maturity in order for the mind to even really be available for this teaching. Right? And so this is what Ramana says when he says this mati means mind. Durbalatvam. Bala means strength. Durbala means it's a state of being weakened. The strength is weakened, right? Because these emotional qualities are there that get in the way. But say these qualities, say a person does have a high degree of all of these different qualities, then the mind is actually available, right, to recognize what is being said. Because you see, so then I'll go on with this next line because it goes into this. He says, why is it weakened? You know, why do you say that? He says, tet sarvada swatmatiya hibhati. Because that self, that paramatma, that self, which is changeless and free, that is always shining there as your own being. It's always there. It's not, there's no distance. It actually is you. It's not that you have to have a meditative experience to fly into some subtle realm to experience it. No. It is the very being that you are right now, fully present to all of the thoughts and experiences of your mind. There's nowhere to go at all. It is already an accomplished fact that, in fact, you can't do anything about it. You can't make it better. You can't make it worse. You can't make it more spiritual or less spiritual. You can do nothing. It's just a matter of recognition, you know. Now, why would that be so hard? Well, it's hard because the mind has other things it needs and other things it wants to do and other desires, you know. Like, I want things to be like that, and I want to do this, and I want to do that. It doesn't have time. You know, you need a lot of inner space, you know, and inner conviction, actually, inner viveka, inner discrimination, to even have any such desire, to even know this. Because the mind is very busy, and it's very busy trying to make itself happy. It's very busy trying to make you happy by fulfilling your desires and getting things to be the way that you want them. And that is, I would say, there's layers and layers and layers of subtlety around how we want things to be. You know, it can start out just very, you can look at the very gross ways that you want things to be different. But there's a whole internal world also. Can be very sophisticated, the things that you want, you know, how you want to be, how you want your mind to be, how you want your body to look, how you want it's endless. To really get a feel for it, you just have to watch your own mind, you know. And what do you look for? All of the moments when you feel dissatisfied. Like, it can be very subtle, just subtle dissatisfactions you can blow off, you know. Like, you know, I feel uncomfortable with that. And then you can say, well, why do you feel uncomfortable with it? What is it? What is it that you want to be different? You know? Just be a little bit, just be with yourself a little bit, you know. Here's a little distinction. I can want something to be different, but be fine if it's not. That's vairagya. That's what we mean by dispassion. I can want something to be different. I can have choices. I can have preferences. But if I don't get it that way, I'm fine with it. Then that thing is not causing any problem at all. It's when I want something to be different, and if it is not different, I am not okay. That's what we're talking about. So you have to make, this is actually a really important little distinction, because otherwise I have to say, oh, I can never want anything to change, or I can never want anything actually. Because if you want something, that means you're not happy with what you have. But that's not it. You can want lots of things. We have like everything. It doesn't make any difference. We have the desire, this is the desire template. I want this, right? And this stands for anything. I want this. And why do I want this? So that I can be happy. That means I have a lot at stake, because if I don't get it, I won't be happy. Right? What if I want this, but if I don't get it, I'm fine? It's totally different. And so if the whole world can turn into that, I want this, or I don't want this, that's just the negative side of it. I don't want this. Why? So that I can be happy. Because if I have to have this, I am not going to be happy. So if I say, I don't want this, but if it comes, I'll deal with it. You know, it's not a preference, but if it comes, I'll deal with it. What does that mean? My well-being is not at stake. That's vairagya. Some people misunderstand vairagya, or dispassion, as this type of thing, you know, where, you know, keep it away from me, you keep these things away from me, I have dispassion toward them. That's passion. Dispassion, the example Swamiji uses for it, I like, is the helium balloon for a child. You know these helium balloons? My dad used to take us down to Santa Cruz for the boardwalk, and we'd always get to get one of these balloons. And what would always happen is many different things. Either one of us would let it go, and it would fly up into the, and that would be very sad. Or somebody's balloon wouldn't have been tied tight enough. And so it starts collapsing and, you know, shriveling up. That's also a bad, bad thing. And so for a child, you know, a helium balloon, its behavior, how long it stays, all of those things are very important, you know, can be. But probably for you as an adult, it really doesn't matter. You can enjoy the balloon while it's there. If it gets let go, that's fine too. If it pops, oh well, it's popped. It's okay. It's fine. There's nobody, nothing, no great ananda, fullness superimposed on this balloon or Jax or whatever it is that children love but you don't need. Right? And that, see, the tricky thing to understand here is that you can really enjoy a helium balloon. And you can have a lot of fun with Jax or marbles. As an adult, you can really enjoy it. But the thing is, when it goes, it is absolutely fine. And so to the degree that we're that way toward the universe, to that degree, we're free. Right? And you will be that way and are that way to almost everything. But there's those few. And it just takes a few. At any given time, there's a few that you don't have that freedom. Yeah. And so those are what we would say, it's those areas that are our sadhana. That's our sadhana. That's where that's where the universe is presenting us with our job. Our job is to, in terms for mumukshu, is to really become free, internally free in life, in that space. Yeah. And that's where the whole world, we say the whole world is your sadhana. You know, it's just Bhagavan is continually, the Lord is continually, you know, giving you challenges to help you to become a big person and help you to grow. And so that's and that's enjoyable for a mumukshu because I am trying to grow. I'm trying to become a whole, full, complete person in reference to the world. And so I don't mind doing that work. That's a good attitude. I don't mind doing the work. That's what I'm about. That's what I'm doing. So let me do that work. You know, that's a beautiful, beautiful attitude to have. And you enjoy the fruits also of it as you mature and as you grow. It's a beautiful thing. But you know, you also have to move in a step to really have the vairagya that's, you have to also have that freedom toward your own mind and its ability to be good as well as its ability to be bad. Like what if you say, my mind was really, really nice today. It's really calm. It's really, really did well. I did well today. But then another day comes and it's just a mess. You know, there's emotional reactions and, you know, feeling depressed and down or whatever it is, all kinds of things going on. And now you say, you know, you say, no. What if you didn't say no? What if you said that's okay? That's okay. For one thing, if you can say that, and I mean seriously say it, not pretend. It's okay. There's a lot of things that happen there. One, you have some vairagya. You don't require that your mind, you know, step two all the time, which it's not going to do anyway. But you give it some space and you give it some friendship. And just like with the world, the world's not behaving like you want it to, so that's okay. Then you're a friend, right? You're not beating on it to step two to do exactly what you need it to do. You don't need it to do that. It's okay. Hey, you're a friend. If you're a friend, then you're a friend inside. Right? You can't be a friend, enemy outside and a friend inside. Right? And if you're a friend inside, you'll be a friend inside too. And so it's the same with your mind and your states of mind. That's okay. That takes some maturing. It takes some maturing and it takes some time, you know, to develop into that. And what really allows you to develop into that freedom in reference to your own mind in its own slow maturing process, whatever it has to go through, is your recognition that Paramatma Nishtha, the recognition of just the simplicity of your own being that really doesn't care what your mind is doing at all. It is there fully, 100%, totally present, illumining the most creepy vrittis, the most creepy thoughts, as well as the most beautiful thoughts. It is there exactly in exactly the same way. And so from that standpoint, you are not being affected. Your ananda is not being affected. Your wholeness is not being affected. And so when that is really, as that becomes more and more assimilated, your mind can simply relax into that fact of that. And you can say, you have the freedom to say it's okay. And you can say, you know, like, I wouldn't choose my mind to be miserable. I wouldn't choose for my house to be dirty either, you know. I would like my mind to be, you know, calm and clean and, you know, just relaxed and all of that. But if I say, that's okay, I'm also saying, don't worry, we'll work on it. I'll work on it, you know. That's what we do. We'll work on it. It'll be fine, you know. It doesn't matter. So that type, there's a lot of tremendous amount of freedom in that, but you have to, that's why these are the qualities of a mumuksha, as of a mumuksha, an adhikari, a qualified student for this knowledge, means somebody who has recognized that they need to have this knowledge. Because they can't, you realize so fully that you cannot control the universe to make it into something that will give you any type of wholeness or fullness that lasts. And that's your experience, momentary fullness, momentary fullness, momentary fullness. And so Amji always jokes and say, you know, sukha. Sukha means like pleasurable state. Sukha is happy. And dukkha means sad. So you go like this. You know, you think it's going to be sukha, dukkha. This is your life. Sukha, dukkha. Sukha, dukkha. Sukha, dukkha. He says, no, it's not like that. It's sukha, dukkha, 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 dukkha. Sukha, dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. Because we're very sophisticated in our needs, you know.
Yeah.
So slowly, slowly, slowly these things are given up. So he says, we do keep doing that vichara, you know. But the vichara itself, as we'll see when we get next time, when we get into this next verse, the vichara helps me to release all of the mind to release itself. To release itself from this mess that has been created because of self-ignorance. Yourself is already here. It is already perfect. It is already fine. Nothing needs to be done at all. But the mind, because of ignorance, there's no viveka, there's no differentiation between your own presence and all these experiences that are happening. The mind is capable of creating terribly painful situations. Very capable of doing that. Just creating tensions, all kinds of tensions and terrible situations. And yourself, very, very sweetly, very gently, without any preferences whatsoever, just simply illumines that terrible situation. And it itself, like the sun shining, illumining the thundercloud, the sun doesn't think, I don't want to illumine that cloud. Doesn't think anything. It simply illumines the cloud. It can be the most violent thundercloud, or it can be a clear sky. The sun doesn't say, I don't want the thundercloud. You know, I want the clear sky. You know, it doesn't say anything. This simply is. Like that, you simply are. Absolutely whole and full and complete as you are. But the mind, because of self-ignorance, is on some wild rides. And that's what has to slowly, slowly, you know, be taken care of by this knowledge and your mind's assimilation of this knowledge. And so that's why he says, you know, this vichara, it shows some weakness of mind in terms of these qualities, because there really is no problem in reference to yourself. It's just that the mind is acting out in this way or the other, you know, because of self-ignorance, really. And so when the mind settles down, once it understands, then that there is no need for vichara, there's no need for anything. Everything is perfect as it is. Nice. He explains it more next verse. We'll stop here though.
Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha
Hadith Om.
Strange that your own being doesn't just announce itself to the mind, and that it would be nice if that was a faculty. You know?
Yeah. They said that Katha Upanishad said Bhagavan made a mistake. He made the self and everything, but then there's no pramana.
Yeah.
And so, but there is a pramana. It's just not attached. Pramana means of knowledge. It's like your eyes, your sense organs are all focused outward to gain knowledge of what exists within duality. And the mind is just, has for its very being the self, but the mind takes that being, that the self, for granted as itself. And what's so funny is that it is itself. But the difference is that the relationship or the order of reality that the mind enjoys is different than the order of reality that the self enjoys, because the mind is Maya by its very nature. It's continually changing and doesn't have any real substance apart from the self. You know, just like the pot doesn't have any substance apart from the clay. You know, the mind doesn't have any being apart from the self, and it doesn't have the capacity, therefore, to even change or touch the self in any way, but the self is it's a very essence. But then the mind, how does the mind know that its essence, its essential nature, is not thinking and having feelings and having emotions? So it's like the red hot iron ball that looks as like one entity. So the mind says, I am the conscious being and I'm miserable. I'm the conscious being and I'm smart, or I'm stupid, or whatever it is, you know. And that's why that knowledge has to come in to make that viveka, that discrimination between what is, when pointed out, very, very obvious, because in your own experience there is something which is absolutely stable and everything else that isn't. There's one thing which is stable, changeless, and everything else. And so it just takes a little discernment. That which is stable or changeless is not something which is not bound by time. That means it's not going to be an object in the world, but it's the very nature of you, the subject. The ultimate subject is not going to be an object, right? The ultimate subject of you can't be an object, in fact. And so it's not subject to any type of objectification or change. It's kind of the bottom line. But you'd say every experience that you have is really pervaded and not away from you, the conscious being. But there's a difference between you, the conscious being, and all the experiences that come and go. So you have to just note that. Like we did in that meditation today. We're just sitting there trying to make note of that. You know, the thing is it's so extraordinarily simple. You know, when we think of something like self-knowledge or liberation and all these big words, those words add complexity to something that is so simple, simple beyond words, really. And that makes it difficult. Ramana says, you know, the Vedas, they very clearly say that you are the infinite self. And in the commentator, there's a nice commentary on it, says, he doesn't say, so he elaborates on it, he doesn't say that you will be that, you know, or you have to do something to become that. He says, you are that. So there's no becoming here. There's no place to go. You're already there. You already are it. You know, and so You have to just recognize, there's a recognition involved of something that is 100% completely present and could not be more present, in fact. But then if the mind is acting up and directed out here and circling around itself, that mind's really not available. You know, it's available for taking care of itself and its moods and its emotions and its desires and its hurts and all kinds of things. It gets very wrapped up in itself. And so that mind has to be settled down. But if the mind is settled down, then what is being said by the Vedas is extremely obvious, and there's nothing to do about it. You just are told, no, I see. That's what he said. You don't need, why are you doing vichara again? Why are you doing any more analysis? What for? Because you're fully present. What is it?
Well, it's for the mind.
Yeah, because the mind needs to settle down. And everybody has their own path to that settling. There's many, many different aspects to the mind that need settling.
I noticed that it seems like the mind, my mind, has three major, very basic orientations that are in conflict with its self-knowledge, which is becoming something, proving something, and figuring something out. And those orientations just keep pulling the mind back into identification with whatever is required to achieve that.
The figuring something out it should be happy with, though. That I don't see what that. The other two I see as a totally.
I think maybe in part with reference to the self-knowledge, because there are so many words, there are so many. I mean, not even that many, but there are enough pramanas. And if there's an orientation to figure things out, to see some sophistication where really there is only simplicity, and the words seem to serve that orientation, you know, by giving it this opportunity to constantly get more, refine its knowledge.
I see. Yeah, you know, they call that, somebody's talked about this, so they call it a Vedanta Vasana. You know, where you start going after this, what we call this panditium, this state of scholarship, because once you get into the Shastras, you know, the actual scriptures, the Upanishads, there are commentaries on commentaries on commentaries and commentaries on those commentaries and commentaries on those commentaries by great mahatmas and great scholars. And then not only that, then there's all of these prakarana granthas, these explanatory texts that are once removed. And so there's this ocean of shastric study that you can get lost in. You know, and then of course you'll want to learn the nyaya, all of the logic, and then you want to, because there's different darshanas, you need to know all of those different darshanas, those philosophical systems, because Shankara mentions those systems, and then you should also be fluent in Sanskrit, and then if you really want to show off, you can not only be fluent in Sanskrit, but you can learn the Panini Sutras, the Sanskrit grammatical sutras, and yeah. So you can, and it there's something very wonderful about that study also, but you can get lost in it. It can become like what you're doing, rather than that, not that those teachings meant to give you a knowledge. Your interest is in the teachings themselves.
You can pull me out of my ease because there's this pressure to achieve something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to achieve things too. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I don't see it has to be that way. I just notice that's a tendency.
Yeah.
An area where it's easy to get lost and yeah. Start suffering over something that's not really consequential.
Yeah. Like you could have the drive to achieve something without the suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's much better. The other is awful, actually. So you say you're driven to achieve something, and it really matters that you do it. that's a real hard one.
I don't think Ramana had that problem of being overly scholarly. You?
Mm-mm. It wouldn't be relevant. He was already the content of the scholarship, so not going to be thinking like that. Or letting the students think like that.
It sounded, when you're talking about the last of the qualifications, it was approaching, almost describing karma yoga.
Which one?
Well, I don't remember the names well
enough. Oh, you mean the group of them? The Mumukshu twin, the desire for liberation, or the Viveka, the discrimination, Vairagyas, the dispassion, and I did that Shama,
right.
Dhamma, Upadhi.
I think there was some back and forth between the Vairagya and the...
You know, with the Viveka, the discrimination and the Vairagya, it does lead to that emotional freedom of those others, that group that I went, the Shama,
yes.
And an attitude that that Karma Yoga is a naturally comes out of that. You know, where you just see everything as Ishvara and you accept the results of your actions as prasad from the Lord. It's perfect for them.
And then also talking about all of the along with that, you know, that it who knows when moksha will or won't happen. And this lifetime, another lifetime, tomorrow, now. And so that brings up a question for me. It seems like there's a certain amount of preparation that can be done to kind of prepare the ground, prepare our mind, calm it down. And then making that viveka is actually, there's some kind of grace involved. It's not like just something you can intentionally achieve.
Well, you know, I think we'd say it more like this, that this, what, even for the student to come to this teaching with any type of interest, like you might drag your friend here and, you know, they'll sit through it. They'll be polite. They'll never come back again. So there's something, you know, that will hold you to it. So those qualifications are there to some degree. But then it's also the job of it's in the Upanishads, in the teaching itself, to hone that viveka and vairagya, to really unfold it, to make you understand and see it. So you have it, but then the teacher will, not just the teacher teaching the shastra, but I'm saying it's actually in the shastra, will hone it to make you really understand. You know, what you've intuited and recognized, it'll sit with it and make you own it, help you to own it, all of those. And then to own it intellectually understand it, intellectually see it. And then the buddhi, then, now your experiences are coming into that knowledge, which you already had recognized experientially, but now you really understand. And so now your experiences and your desires are coming into a mind, Buddhism's mind, a mind that has more understanding and so deals with it slightly differently. You know, so there's a maturing that naturally takes place. But it takes place slowly. You know, it's like you can be very clear on some things, even about the nature of your own being, the nature of ananda, the whole thing, and then I still want this. I still need this. So it takes a while before it's really not worth it to you to get, you may want this, but it just is not worth it's not worth it to get upset about it. You don't want to get upset or bothered about it, because why should you really? It allows you to act objectively in the world, because your ananda, the fullness that you're seeking, is your own being. And as your mind more and more realizes that, it may want something, but it doesn't have the passion to get excited about it if it doesn't get it. So I think as a person matures, it's you are more your personality more converts into this situation. But this is the situation, and what can I do to help? It's not that I need the situation to be a particular way. This is the situation. This is my prerogative. This is the life that's been given to me. How can I help? What can I contribute? Rather than, what do I need to get from it? But I'm not talking about that. I think that's just a natural maturing. Because your self is truly the source of the ananda, not anything in the world. If something in the world was the source of it, then it would always make you and everybody happy. You know, here's the ananda cup. So, I have it. But I'll share it with all of you, and so now we could all be happy. It's not so. There is no such thing like that that makes you happy. Any given thing doesn't make you happy all of the time. It could be making you happy and another person miserable at exactly the same time. So there's no... It doesn't exist here as an object. It's your very nature that gets as though clouded by the reactions and tensions in your mind. It doesn't really get covered, but your mind is so used... That's misleading what I just said. You are fine. Your being is whole and complete. But the mind is not used to recognizing that. Your presence, that's a body, no matter what the thoughts are, it's not used to that. So all the mind knows is that I can have happy states of mind or sad states of mind. Yourself illumines, which is full and complete of itself, illumines both the happy states of mind and the sad states of mind. But all your mind knows is that let me have a happy state of mind and let me hold on to it as long as I can. It doesn't know that there's somebody there who is perfectly whole and complete, illumining and present to all states of mind. And that's the freedom. Yeah. And then with that recognition, which Ramana is calling the Paramatma Nishtha, where I recognize myself, the wholeness of my own being, then the mind, the pressure is off the mind. Now the mind doesn't care so much about having to do this and that so that I can have a happy state of mind. It's not even dependent on a happy state of mind. It's not dependent on any state of mind. So it's not seeking happy states of mind. You know, and that's a huge relief for the mind.
How can you convince the mind that that's the case? I mean,
it's by that recognition of your own presence. You know, no matter what the state of mind. That's why what I was kind of trying to do in the meditation today and in this teaching, you get used to yourself, which is always the same, no matter what the state of mind. But we have to calm the mind down and get it into a relatively peaceful state of mind so that it has the wherewithal to recognize, you know, yourself. Because otherwise, if the mind is running around and hurt and angry and upset, then... And I remember when I first was listening to Swamiji, I just got to India, and I was really so excited about this knowledge and really understanding it, and then something went wrong, or feelings got hurt, or something, some awful thing happened, and I was sitting in my room on my little cot, bawling, crying, and just so miserable. And I remember as I was, tears running down my face, Brahman, you know, is that whole infinite self. Who cares what Brahman, what difference does it make? Yeah.
What'd you do? Just wait for that to go away? Or?
Yeah, I had to just wait for it to go away. I didn't have much choice. But we had classes all day, satsang all day, so I just went to another class. And, you know. And we have to deal with the mind. We have to deal with our mind, and we have to learn to gain the tools to deal with it, to help it along. Because we're not uttama adhikaris unless you come to this knowledge after you've dealt with everything. You know? or you dealt with it in your last life, and you came to this life, and it's just a clean slate, and there's no problem, and you can't touch on the sea, and that's it. But that's not the case. That's not the case for most of us. We have layers and layers of problems, and unconscious problems, all kinds of things. We have to work through all of that, and we have to know how to be with the mind in a way that is helpful, you know, helpful so that it can... that it can grow in the light of this knowledge, which it definitely will and can do. You know? But it's not overnight. You know, it took a while to pick up all these problems, and it took a while for it to unwind, too.
Yeah. When my son was 12, he said one time, he says, you know, Mom, there's someone always there helping me. And I'm wondering if you really have that.
That's kind of that's that Ishwara Anugraha. That's a grace. Probably brought that with him. You know, there's a why do some people really know that there's a God, you know, or that there's help, you know, and some people don't know that at all, you know, or they think they don't anyway. I had one client many years ago. She was a very committed atheist. She was a committed atheist. She didn't believe in anything. She was made sure to let me know that too. But then she would talk about. She had all of these synchronicities that she would look for. Like, for instance, if she got on the bus, if somebody would give her the seat, then that would mean that it would be a good day. You know? But these are synchronicities, you know, where this would mean that. Like, there's some order. There is some divine order. To, you know, and I pointed that out to her once. And then actually, you know, she told me she was actually grew up in Iran. She's a little girl. She's Iranian. And she told me that... she actually was very religious until she was 12 years old when her grandmother died. Mm-hmm. And her grandmother was the one that gave her all of that. Mm-hmm. And then she started talking about all of her boys. It was interesting because she had somehow shoved that whole thing off, shoved religion totally out of her conscious mind, except that she was always looking for meaning. Mm-hmm. She was always looking for meaning and finding it in synchronous events. It even had to do with crossing streets. It was very complex in some ways. And she's a very honest person. She knew also when we started talking about it. She said, that's right, that's true. And then she went back to her own.
She went back to it, to the spirituality.
No, well, not wholly, but back to her memories of how it was between her and her. And she realized her own kind of her own little version of spirituality that she had, her own recognition that there's something bigger. Not that matters. I don't even know what God did. Just remembered it. Okay.
It's a good study.